go from there. Trevante Jaramillo, I think it's both are still the same day in both of our areas, but we are in different time zones right now. I'm on the Skype horns with Mr. Gavin Bain, a.k.a. Brains McLeod, one half of Syllable and Brains, and co-star of the really awesome documentary, The Great Hip-Hop Hoax. We'll give you guys a little backstory, but I mean, the reason I'm talking to this guy is because the movie is really great.
Thank you.
Crazy story. I'll let you kind of give us like I said, don't give too much of the movie away, because obviously that's the point, but the lead up is what's really bizarre and interesting. So where are you at, man?
Well, I'm just in London right now. My life is it's always been a little bit crazy, but I guess it started back in Dundee, up in Scotland. Me and my best friend, we were just a couple of rappers. You know, we met each other, we got on really well. Within a couple of hours of meeting each other, we started spitting bars. We started playing out scenes from Menace to Society, and just a lot of our favorite movies, as much as discussing our favorite rap records. So we just got on really well. Within a few weeks, we'd formed a rap group together. Within a year, we were good enough, we felt, to go and pursue. We were recording our own stuff and producing our own stuff. We felt good enough to go and pursue a deal. We thought a record deal was the key to success in music. So we went down, we saw this thing online. I mean, this is around 2000. You know, Eminem just released in 98 over here, and it was 96 there, but he filtered through to us over here around 98. And he had a massive impact on the music industry here. If you were a rapper in the UK when his explosion happened, if you were a white rapper, you were just trying to be like Eminem, you know?
Sure, yeah.
Regardless of what accent you had, however you rapped, people were just like, "You're white? Oh, you're trying to be Eminem?" And that was quite annoying.
That's how it happened here, too. It's the same thing. Like, anybody that wasn't black that was trying to get into hip-hop, it was the same accusation, the same deal over here. So,
yeah. And, it went down to, every lyric that we would... I mean, going at celebrities and, you know, we're young dudes at university. Every lyric we were writing was about some sick shit going at people. But as soon as Eminem came out, it was like, oh man, that's his shit. That's his stuff. It's like, what you haven't heard of all the MCs in New York? You haven't heard these guys rip into celebrities? It's been going on for years. But so anyway, we did all we could do in our scene, and we toured like hell. We exhausted all of our options in our country. And then we saw this thing online. It was I think it was Polydor, his label over in the UK, put out a search for the new Eminem. You know, like, are you the next Eminem?
And that was actually what it said.
Yeah, that's what it said online. It was like, are you the next Eminem? It even had a little picture of him, his TV show cartoon picture.
Sure,
you know, and we were kind of like, we were quite annoyed by the likeliness that people kept thinking existed, which didn't exist, because pretty much just because of the skin color. So we thought, well, if everyone's saying this, why don't we go down there and we'll just do our stuff. At this point, we're just rapping in a full-on Scottish accent. And even in England at that point, the music industry hadn't really ever heard anything come out of Scotland like that, you know? So we went down, we did this audition, and man, it was like 2 seconds into the audition, like the first few bars we started to spit, the judges or the A&R panel, more like judges really. This was before X Factor and Pop Idol and all that stuff. But the judges were just kind of laughing at themselves, like, "What is this? You know, what are these dudes doing? What are these moronic Scottish guys doing, thinking they can rap?"
Well, they thought you guys were like kidding, right? Like, even though, I mean, it becomes very apparent when you're watching the movie that you guys have writing skill, you guys have rap skill, you know, you can spit for sure. But they didn't even give you a chance. It was just based on the sound of your accent that
They knew that, when you're trying to get a record deal and you're trying to get your stuff out on a major label. This is a major label. This is Polydor. You know, this is a massive, massive label. when they're trying to put you out, they're going to spend about $1 million on you marketing in the first year. So to them, even though they probably might have heard of like rappers from the UK, you know, and they might have like, that's what they were looking for, but they were just thinking, what's the rest of the world going to think? The rest of the world's going to hear Scottish guys rapping and think, oh, Tartan, you know, Kilts. They're going to think Michael Myers, you know, Fat Bastard from Austin Powers, you know, Babies, you know, they're going to think that. They're not going to think, wow, it's just another country, English-speaking country where people, where there's a massive hip-hop scene. they just couldn't put it together. So sure. We were heartbroken, man. They just told us, look, they actually said to us, you're never going to make it. You sound like the Rapping Proclaimers. Yeah. For us, MCs who were into The Arsonists, who were into Big Pun, our favorite record between us was Big Pun's Capital Punishment. We were spitters. We were like fucking Geronimo, you're on a roll, I'm on the honor roll, like Stephen Hawking's walking. You know, we were like fucking multisyllabic, crazy, like fast spitters. I can't even remember some of the fast shit we used to do. It was crazy fast. But like, they just couldn't see it. They were just like, meh, you know. Like, you know, you're never going to make it. Enjoy that 13-hour bus journey back. So shit. You hop back in a bus.
Why do you think they were so? Why do you think they were so? Just like no, like there was no. It was the only. I think I just asked you this sort of, but like it blows me away that they were so adamant about it never working. Like why? Why do you think that was?
I just think it's because of perception. You know, it's about worldwide perception. They didn't think to themselves for 1 minute that there's so many Scottish, Irish, and British people in America. They couldn't think
that might actually like this stuff, you know? Like, I mean, even like from my end, like I'm more of a metal guy, and I don't know if this really, you know, translates, but
I'm a massive metalhead as well. Yeah.
You know, like the stuff over here that I can think of off the top of my head would be like Dropkick Murphys, you know, even not as heavy, but like the Flogging Molly and all that kind of stuff. Like that shit is huge over here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Not just with your countrymen, with us, you know, we love it. It just seems like it's sad to me that they didn't give the content a shot, you know?
Yeah, that was the most annoying thing. But it was all about perception. When you're launching a major label artist, everything, there's no risk involved. You know, if they go through the kind of like a sheet of criteria, and it's like, okay, number one is never skill, ever. It's never skill. It's what do they look like?
Yeah.
Are girls gonna, a little young girl's gonna like these guys? That's what the number one thing. And then it goes down to, you know, what's the street cred like? Are the streets gonna feel them? And it's kind of like the very last, like 98% of stuff is just absolute bullshit, especially in that time in music. The very last thing is skills. But if you aren't ticking the first few boxes, it's got nothing to do with skills, so they're not going to listen. And that's a horrifying truth. I get artists contacting me all the time, and I'll listen to every single demo they send, but they can't, like so many young artists, the thing that you're sold with TV is that anyone can make it. You can have that one shot.
Right.
That's bullshit. It's really bullshit. If you don't look, if you haven't been blessed with looks, you know, everything that comes off of X Factor and all these shows, apart from maybe that one orange-haired guy that won Play Something, you know, everything else is, it's good-looking, it is sexy, you know, people buy records of the people they want to be like, and I guess they thought, who would want to be like these Scottish guys? Because Scotland is known worldwide as a nation of drinkers, of no-hopers, you know, so the perception didn't work for them.
Well, let me ask you this, though. I mean, you and, you know, Billy, you guys aren't bad-looking dudes. Like, why, you still didn't make that cut initially? Because, part of the thing that you guys talk about at the beginning of the movie is how much ass you guys could crush, like, before any of this even started. Like,
like I wasn't bragging about that. He was.
Oh, okay, okay.
But, that's a really good point. Basically, I wasn't really that confident a dude, in all honesty. And Syllable, he could just walk up to girls and just bam. You know, he could really just get in there. He had crazy ass hair. He looked like the real deal. And in fact, the thing that's left out of the film is that he actually did get a callback. He got a callback.
Oh, wow.
And he went, that's in my book. You know, he went back down there to find out what it was they were actually looking for. And then at that second callback, they asked him to rap in an English accent. And at that point, he told them to fuck off. So that's the weird thing. They were actually looking for the next Eminem in an English accent, but a Scottish accent didn't work, which is so fucked up.
So crazy. Ridiculous.
But it's an interesting point because we didn't look bad. It was just that we were like proper underground hip hop heads. You know, like we wore big camel jackets. You know, we came from punk rock. We were in punk rock bands through school and stuff. We massive punk rock and metal heads. But at that point in our lives, we were so immersed in hip-hop culture, and we perpetuated so many rap stereotypes. Our clothing was all camel. It was all, like, dark, and we had that, you know, attitude. So they just kind of thought, nah, Scottish dudes with that, it doesn't work, it doesn't fit. So when we created the Syllable and Brains characters, because we literally didn't have any other choice, if we wanted success on a major scale, all we did was, I mean, I remember the two of us actually standing in front of the mirror with our girlfriends kind of quite close and just being like, why don't you guys just do your hair like this? Why don't you just wear this? Hey, why don't you wear that basketball top? Why don't you just, okay, from now on, you guys are just going to wear basketball tops. And we were like, okay, we're going to stop wearing the dark camel stuff that reflected our mood when we were listening to like underground artists like Arsonists and LP and all that. Now we're going to dress like Tupac. Now we're going to dress like the West Coast of rap, you know, like how people dress in California.
Sure.
And we're going to perpetuate those stereotypes. We're going to make fun of gangster rap in a really satirical way. We're going to kind of be a mixture of Chris Tucker, the comedian, with Redman, his attitude. And we're going to take the piss out of people like Lil Wayne and all that. And all that. That's kind of the idea where we're going for.
What made you guys decide California? That was another thing I was kind of curious about, because like there's a whole country over here, and America was the thing, right? It wasn't just so much California.
Yeah.
But why did you pick California?
Well, actually, Bill does have family in Hemet, California.
Okay.
So that was, we knew that, you know, if in devising a backstory, which we never really, we just kind of looked at Eminem's iconology and just kind of made a bit of a story out of that, like what meeting at the Warped Tour in San Francisco, you know, things like that. But it was all linked to things in California, because that was the only places that Bill had been to. So he did know certain landmarks. He knew certain things.
Oh, sure.
So
if anybody was like, what was it like in California? Like, oh yeah, we were always down San Diego Beach or, you know, that type of shit. Okay. Makes sense.
Yeah, and his ability to get us out of holes came in handy. Because I'll be honest, man, at that point, I didn't even know the difference between California and Los Angeles. I didn't know the difference between one is a city and one is a city. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
So I got caught out. There's one case I talk about in my book where I got caught out by an American MC who was over here, and he kind of asked me, like, oh, whereabouts in LA are you from? Whereabouts in California from? And I just kind of got the mixed up between California and LA. Oh no, he said what state? He said state from? And I said LA. That was the thing. I said LA, and then he said, "Sorry, man, what's?" I said, "What state are you from?" And I said, "I'm from LA." And he was like, "What?" And then the syllable kind of cut in. He was like, "Ah, no, it means like, you know, we have an LA state of mind, you know."
Smooth talker.
So it's kind of like Syllable was always kind of jumping in and kind of saving the day of like my lack of like knowledge of California. And sure. We didn't really spend much time on an actual story. It was just a case of like be these American, like over the score characters, over the score rappers, get the deal and then come clean, release a single and then come clean on a famous British TV show.
Okay.
And let me super naive.
Let me fast forward the story a tiny bit.
Don't want to get too much.
Yeah, exactly. So what happens essentially is, I mean, you guys become these two California guys for two solid years, and there's like some major conflict, obviously, that comes out of this because you guys were friends, but then like, I mean, now you're dealing with four guys instead of two guys, but not really, right? Like you guys were basically Syllable and Brains. Like there wasn't really like a going back to the other guy, right? Or was that just for you, maybe?
No, we were in character. We knew pretty early on that we were gonna have to do this full time. One of the first people that Sony, that we met was a guy called Dougie, who was actually Scottish. And our accents, he could hear the flaws in our accents. So, I mean, that was because we were speaking to each other in Scottish and then putting the accent on when we would meet people when we came to London. But we knew...
Hang on, man.
We're going to do this in the characters and only allow ourselves to... Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah. It drops out a little bit. I got you now. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so we felt we had to immerse ourselves in the character or else the accent would slip. And eventually, for me, it was 5 years. I was in the character for 5 years, but Syllable and Brains together was two, yeah. And yeah, it was just us, man. I mean, and we brought a band in, but really we had to speak to everyone in the accents. And after a while, we kind of started to believe we were the characters. It gets really weird, you know, you start to believe in your lies. Some things you don't realize if that was a lie or if that was a real thing.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Like a thought of your history.
You know, and we also. I had this one thing happen, and I'm not embarrassed to tell you because we're just talking for the first time. But I really don't want to tell this to people that listen to this. But you know the movie Scarface? Have you seen that?
Yeah.
All right.
I just sampled it. Yeah.
Oh, really? Nice. You have to send that one to me. I love that. I love that whole score, even though it's kind of cheesy and weird. But I saw that movie probably, I think it was the 20th anniversary edition, which would have been 2003, probably, I'm going to say. And
yeah.
I completely took on that stupid fucking voice that he does.
For the little walk.
Yeah, exactly. I'd be like, hey, how you doing, huh? Hey, honey. Now, that was kind of more Dice than fucking than Tony Montana, but no, like for I was really like I live. It's a pretty small town, but there was one club that I was at all the time, and not only that, but I was there in suits all the time. So I'm like, well, hey, I'm gonna when I get drunk, especially, this shit's gonna be what happens. And like it went on for way too long. It went on for a couple months, and for no reason. I'm not trying to dupe anybody or like it was just some stupid thing that I started doing. Ugh, God, I'm all hot telling that.
You love and you learn, you know what I mean?
I was a dumbass and still am. But anyway, it's just insane. Like the immersion in the characters is really what's interesting about this movie. And like, I know you can't speak for Billy, but it seemed like it didn't seem to really like stick on this point too long, but it seemed like he was able to kind of like when things kind of went downhill, he was like, ah, fuck this. And he went to go be like in his regular life again, kind of easily. What do you think was the difference between him and your situation?
It was very different. I mean, it's a longer, it took me quite a while actually comes to.
Sorry, brother, it's cutting out again.
I'll wait till it comes back on. You hear me now?
Yeah, I gotcha. See, that's why I hate these Skype ones. We should next time we talk, we should do it over the phone or something.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Bill had met the girl who he ended up marrying, Mary. They met quite early on. I only knew Bill for a while longer, and yeah, he met his sweetheart. So I had to convince him to come down. You know, it was both of our. We can't take the kind of the full acclaim over what we did because it was a bit of both of our. We knew we both had to do it together, and also we wanted to share responsibility equally.
Sure,
but
yeah.
I had no other option. You know, I really viewed it like this is at 16. I decided I wanted to be. I saw a Method Man on stage, and I decided I want to be him. I wanted to be a half between Method Man and Zach De La Rocca. That's what I wanted to be. And I decided very early that was it. And as soon as I decide on something, it's almost impossible not to follow through. So my sister had moved to London. One of our best friends had just died. And I literally couldn't go anywhere without seeing his face and reflections everywhere. And I was just like, I've got to get the fuck out of here. And I knew that we were talking about these characters. And then I also had entered us in a competition. We won the competition. It was with the American accents. We won the competition, and it just became obvious that we were going to have to do this. If we did do it, we could be heroes. We could put Scottish music on the map. We could stop. We could inspire our friends' bands who were just giving up when they couldn't get acclaim and success. They would just give up. And we wanted to stop that. We wanted to prove that Scottish artists could make it and make it on the worldwide scene. But Bill, I had to convince him because he was falling in love. You know, love's a strong thing. I was with my girlfriend, but my love for music was far stronger, you know. Sure. But Bill was falling head over heels. So he always had like a time period. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
He was away from his family, away from his, you know, away from everyone.
He had like an end date, like, we got to get this thing done.
Yeah. And when we initially started it, we realistically thought it would last 3 weeks, and then someone would find us out and be like, "Fuck off, you get out of here, your chances," you know. But it didn't. Within a few weeks, we were in these characters. We were able to get more meetings. We were able to con our way into so many different events. We were everywhere. Our plan of action was so superb that we forced out our way everywhere. We did one show at Island A&R. Chris Rock saw us. We saw us doing our freestyle thing with the crowd, you know, picking on the crowd and stuff. He called us in to the Warner Island offices the next morning. We took that opportunity to cause a buzz by going in, and we started in the boardroom. We started ripping the shit out of people's hair and what they were wearing, and, you know. So that spread. The very next thing that happened is everyone that was in that boardroom started texting all their friends throughout the industry. So the word spread, like, there's two M&Ms in London, and they're looking for a deal. So it took off pretty quick. Once we got Jonathan Shallow on board as a manager, we'd come to London with very little money, like probably about £360 between us. And within 3 months, we'd taken on a 70,000 management, publishing, and then we've got the major labels. So the money just starts stacking up, and then the endorsements were coming in, and we were being punted as the next big thing. These Californian rappers who have British descent who are here to be the new Eminems. And it was quite unreal, because some of our we were able to do shows with some great guys. We were able to work with the Beatnuts and be backstage freestyling in cyphers with Mos Def and Talib Kweli. And we were blowing dudes away. People were kind of hearing us and being like, "Holy shit! Like that, these dudes are the next Eminem," you know. So we it wasn't a case of we just had skill. It was a case of our heroes were letting us know that we're the next in line. You know, so
that's pretty huge. So, like, and I was wondering how the money thing kind of blew me away, because like what was happening was like. You know, like you said, money's stacking up, things are happening, parties are going down. But like, how did you keep like pushing things back without like creating the work that was the point in the first place?
Well, when we first got the management and publishing deal, we had the studio. We were in the studio. Actually, the place where I still work out of now. We were in the studio 3 months straight. Just recording well, our management, and giving all the tracks to the management, and they were going and like, you know, they were going to the States, having meetings with Def Jam and just going everywhere. I think they even met with like Walt Disney Records, you know.
Yeah,
they were
sure.
going all over the world, you know, basically selling these cartoon characters, these larger than life, unapologetic American badasses. They were selling the American dream worldwide. And it was really easy. One of the first things that happened was we had the Sony America, the head of Sony America, fly over to see us, Dave Massey. So when he was blown away and asking us, "Why are you here?
Right.
Why are you in the UK? Let's go back, come back home." So we were and the thing is, a lot of people online have said, but their American accents weren't that good early on. But you're only really seeing like, you know, certain footage where it was a bit shaky. But it was the confidence. It was the confidence to be able to be in front of an American and act like them, and without even knowing. You could have asked us at any point. You could have asked us what grade we finished high school in, what our area code was. We wouldn't have known any of that stuff.
Right.
All
right.
We knew was what we had seen in music videos, what we had seen in episodes of Friends. We had no idea really of like true American culture. Funny thing happened when I was in the character years later, I was still in the character, but one of my best friends is Andy. He's a drummer in a phenomenal drummer, and he's the lead in a show called Stomp in the UK. And but he's from Boston. And I remember the one time I was staying over at his place, and he was like, "Oh, dude, I got mac and cheese," you know. And I was just kind of like, "So," but that's like such a big deal, like mac and cheese and a certain brand of mac and macaroni and cheese. And I was just like, "All right, cool." But he kind of clicked on and was like, "Something not right here," right. You know. So yeah, but we just had that ability, the confidence to just, you know, do it. And we were so immersed in it. It was really like playing a role, playing a big method acting, really.
Right. One thing that I always like, not always, but it's just the thing that I, you know, personally struggle with, or maybe I don't struggle with, maybe I live with it and I should be struggling with it, but that would be like the booze, you know? When you yeah. When you guys were, you know, getting around parties and stuff like that, and you guys had like your own, that's one thing that I also thought was cool, is you guys had your own hand cam footage of all this shit, which is amazing and you know, good, because there was like the times when things would kind of slip, or you would kind of, you know, give a wink to whatever was going on, but you wouldn't drop it, you know. Did that affect, this is kind of a lame question, but like how quickly and how badly did it affect the two of you, like on your natural levels, not the characters?
Yeah, I mean, booze was a big thing. I mean, at first we knew that we couldn't be. We both knew that we had major issues with alcohol, and you know, once we drink a certain amount, we turn into some real fucking assholes. So that's more of a Scottish affliction, I think.
Yeah, sure.
But we knew early on that we had to kind of buy one beer. Also, we were broke at the start, so we'd buy one beer, we'd take it to we'd fill it up with water, and you know, fuel the perception like we're fun guys, but we were pretty much acting. But eventually, when the money was flowing, and you know, when you get these deals, you actually don't even spend any money on booze. Everything's free. People are buying you everything. You're getting you're completely jacked every single day. We would be drunk from morning till night, wake up, hit the road, be drunk again all day long. It was 24/7. And that, with alcohol and, you know, like whatever else we were on at the time, that really started to help blur the lines of reality, you know? Because we were, you know, your ego when you're on booze just jumps another level, you know? So we were really starting to believe in these characters when we were drunk. And we'd start, it made it really difficult, because the stories that we were telling, we'd start here, because we were kind of method acting and improvising pretty much. We'd start here with a story, but we'd get drunk. And we'd just put bigger and bigger pieces to the puzzle, and just come up with all sorts of crazy things, like, you know, all sorts of stuff. We'd just make up, "Oh, yeah, man, yeah, we once battled them and stuff." And just throw levels of craziness on. And when you're out drunk with people, those little lies would keep fueling what we were.
You'd be at a party like 2 months later, and they'd be like, "Hey, tell us that time you saw Redman taking a piss behind." Like, ah, fuck.
Totally. I mean, that came back to bite us in the ass in a big way. When, I mean, you see in the film what happens when, you know, the D12 tour comes in. But
oh, that scene's amazing.
I still, when I watch that, you know, absolutely cringe, because it was like that. It was like, oh my god, we're going to get blown out of the water. Because a big part of the lie that was that we were part of Eminem's crew, and you know, part of the D12 crew. And so when we signed our deal, there was a guy in the office at Sony who was like, "Oh yeah, like you guys are like Eminem's crew, right?" And we were kind of like, "Yeah," and we just let them go with that. We let them create that themselves, and that became a big thing. So. I remember the guy trying to catch us out, and when we were signing, he was just kind of asking us all sorts of crazy questions. And then a few months later, when that Eminem D12 tour came in, it was like, man, this lie has caught up to us in a big way now. Like, we are going to get blown out of the water badly here. But
the show went up, though, right?
Yeah. We just, Bill and I had this way when we were working together, that no matter what the problem is, we just jump in the deep end and sort it out. You know, we just go with it. And I guess because I firmly believe that because our intentions weren't to rip anyone off, and our intentions weren't, as many people think, for fame, essentially. Our intentions were pretty much that we just wanted to get our stuff out there. We weren't trying to hurt anyone. We had very good intentions, and we had talent, and this was a way to show our talent.
Can I tell you
what? And we showed so many levels of that talent. We showed levels of acting, confidence. You know, it was one talent highlight in another. So,
wait a minute. You're going to try to say that this whole thing proved that you're like a triple threat? That's some bullshit. Look, he can dance, he can act, he can rap. Fuck. Yeah, let me tell you one of my favorite lines in the movie. It was who is asking the questions when you guys are doing the interviews?
That was the director, Jeannie.
Okay, yeah, she asked you, like, did you ever feel bad about taking the money and spending the money? And yeah, you were just like, no. And I thought that was great. Like, why? Fuck it. Why would you? You know?
And exactly.
I've explained the movie to a couple people, and they're like, that's craziness. And I'm like, well, yeah, but who cares? Like, who are they hurting? You know?
Yeah. And it was crazy. It was batshit crazy. It really was. But for us, it was the only option. I mean, we were basically sitting facing defeat. You know, we were told that because you're Scottish, there's no way for you to make it. And we felt so hurt by that. The whole plan was fueled by anger, frustration, and completely being oppressed, you know, which is where hip hop came from. You know, it was a culture oppressed, you know.
Now,
I feel like it's kind of, we lost our way in many ways, the same way hip hop's lost its way. You know, hip hop is a fashion statement now instead of about the skills, you know. So, and that kind of happened to us. We completely fell in love with being able to get away with murder, you know. And that was a tricky time to do that. We were young kids. We were like 21. And that's a real important time in a young dude's life, that you learn all these things and you mold who you are. So we were in real danger of kind of cementing these asshole characters. And if anything, what happened after Syllable and Brains and the break between us was such a devastation that it actually taught us so many phenomenal lessons, you know, that, you know, I'm not one who looks back at it and goes, oh, you shouldn't lie. I say, fuck it. Do whatever it takes to get where you I don't care about the lying thing. The true thing about Syllable and I is that we have such huge ambitions, and we didn't think that we were lying to ourselves. We weren't really lying to ourselves. We knew we had the skills and deserved to be touring with people like Eminem and D12. So for us, it wasn't really a lie. It was just marketing. Like you said, we weren't bad-looking guys. We just shaved the faces, gave ourselves braids. We, you know, put a new confidence camouflage on, and boom, all of a sudden we're marketable. I consider that like more of a lie, you know, just like changing your appearance. But that's what people do every single day.
Yeah, that's how it happens with a lot of artists. I mean, the whole.
For sure.
I mean, right now, I can't stand people that hate on Miley Cyrus because, like, she's the best. She's 20, and I get to see her half naked every other day. You know, fucking
who
get
can
out there.
Complain?
Exactly. But, like, that's the whole thing. Like, I mean, somebody is back behind the scenes going, like, you know, it would be great. We go over to Ireland and we do, you know, like a little midget band while she's out there singing it. And, like, it's brilliant. I mean, it might be fucked up, but she's keeping on top. So I agree with you in that point.
It's genius marketing. And the thing is, with Syllable and Brains, the way we kind of always looked at it is like, artists get signed, even if you're in a punk and metal band, like so many bands get signed and then they bring in a producer, they bring in writers, they bring in people to make you commercial.
To create you, yeah.
You know, how many of your favorite bands have you seen being like badass dudes and then they get signed and all of a sudden they're clean cut and they've got the song in a superhero movie and all of a sudden kids love them and it's like, it's all marketing. You know, it's all marketing. That to me is a bigger lie. Syllable and Brains, we actually produced all our own music. We wrote all our own songs. No one did anything for us. We actually did it ourselves.
So you're telling me that you're still really bitter about the Nickelback thing?
But Nickelback. Hate that band. But yeah, we kind of fooled the industry by playing their game on them. And that's what we always intended to do. And people are kind of, the thing that annoys me with the what's happened after the film is people contact me all the time going, oh, man, I hope you're doing well. You know, like they think I'm like this tortured artist. You know, it's like, I hope you're doing all right, man. You're always in it for the love. And I'm like, yeah, you know, but like they come at me like I, because obviously they kind of overdose and all that's in the film. But they come at me with sympathy. And the thing is, what happened with Syllable Brains, the fact that we never released was phenomenal, because if we had released, we would have, and it came out that what we were doing, you know, we would have just been considered like Milli Vanilli. We would have been, our skill would never have seen the light of day. People would never have given us the chance to say what we were doing and why we were doing it. They would have condemned us. And so we would have been Vanilla Ice. We would have been just some pop thing. So the fact that we never got to release, and now we can put our real music, and we've got documentaries, and we just signed a motion picture, and there's so much legs to the story. That's just worked out fantastic for us, you know.
Let me ask you this, because it is something I was thinking about, and you brought it out when you said how people come at you now. Like, do you feel like, I sort of felt that you were portrayed as like the one that like, look at, you know, it didn't really work out for him. At least Billy had some like a half a net to fall back on when it all took a shit, you know. Do you feel like you were like portrayed strangely or like edited strangely, or was it just, was that reality? You were actually sadder than him?
It's a reality that I was portrayed deliberately in a negative light. I mean, I had a bit of an issue with the director. She tried to get the rights to do the documentary initially, and I turned him down because I was working with Irvin Welsh on the movie. So I turned that down, and then they went and they got Bill on board. And since that point, there was just no repair in the relationship between her and I. So, I mean, I saw all the versions of the film up until the release point. So there was so much stuff where people had said nice things about me. All my people that they interviewed said nice things. And in the final version,
everybody's crying.
But everything that anyone said, like as soon as they said, like, you know, my best friend who I still live with, he's an amazing rapper, I still work with him all the time, Oscar, he says he has a nightmare to work with. But then the very next thing he said was, but you need someone like that in a studio to get things done. But they cut that right out. So it just goes,
Jesus.
So he's an asshole. It's like, cut. And even, you know, like they use my sister, negative things, my cousin, negative things. And it was like, there's no one that says anything positive about me in this movie. So I agreed. I agreed before it came out. I kind of had to sign off on it. And I just said, look, fuck it, I'll play the bad guy, I don't care. You know, like, if it'll fuel the perception, whatever. If people want the real story, they can buy the book and they can, you know, wait and see the motion picture. It didn't make me hate the film enough, because 60 minutes of the film are so accurate. It's just that I was already having success. I'm in a punk rock band called Hopeless Heroic, and we were touring. We did like 175 shows last year. So, and we were breaking records and touring. We were selling more records than major label bands, and you know, we were doing really well. We kind of exploded because we worked so hard and we kind of killed ourselves on the road. But we had all the success happening, and in the film, there's no mention of the fact that I'd written a book that kind of exploded the whole story. So it was kind of like, it's not like I'm majorly annoyed. It's just that I've been doing pretty well. The last 5 years, I've lived off of music alone. I've made a book, and my music has kept me alive. That for me is success.
But just so I understand, you're saying that, like, you agreed to be part of the process, but you also knew that they were going to make you look like the dick in the whole thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I was wondering about that. Like, it seems obvious that you guys aren't or weren't working together. Like, you guys were never in the same room or whatever during this, I don't assume. But it did seem really weird, because like they still portray you, like, you know, kind of talking about the craziness and like how bad it got, but they never show him really talking about that stuff. And I wondered if that was like purposeful or if that was just how it really was, you know?
Yeah, I mean, look, I put my book out there, and the book pretty much told the story. I had to tell both. We weren't talking at the time that I put my book out, so I had to tell both sides of our stories inside of my autobiography. And that caused a lot of problems again between Bill and I, because I couldn't say certain things about him. I had to move things around, so he was a bit angry about that. And so the film initially was syllable story. It was his side of the story as an answer back to the book. And when I came on board, they interviewed me a lot, and then it was like, it changed the whole project because they couldn't make that documentary. Because, again, like they say in the film, and they made a big point of saying it in the film, is that there's no brains without syllable. There's no syllable without brains. It's syllable and brains. So when I came on board, then things started to change. But we saw the final. I mean, Bill and I were talking at the end of last year, and we were talking about getting back together as a group and doing it right this time. So it was kind of like we both agreed, like, man, this film is kind of one-sided. It's a bit shit towards either one of us at certain times. So we kind of tried to get things edited, but they just said, no, it's perfect the way it is. So we're like, all right, fuck it. Let it go, you know.
So the thing about the whole story is, like, first of all, it's great because there's very little like it that I've ever heard of. That didn't mean that you guys were completely out of the business, because you guys aren't. That's what's cool about it. Like, somehow you got your reprieve and now things can move forward. But the other thing is, like, you know, no matter how you paint it, you can paint it five different ways. You guys still kind of both look like dicks, like, to me, you know. And, like, that's the unavoidable part. And the fact that you guys come up and go, like, well, yeah, okay, yeah, we were dicks for 2 years. Sorry. And, you know, now you're just, like, kind of coming out and doing it again. I think that's really cool.
I mean, also, we were young.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's very rare that people have their life, when you know, their life from 21, 22, 23, like, put on screen. Do you know what I mean? Like, we watched some of that footage, and we're just like, oh, my God, dude. We are fucking cunts, you know? Well, we the good thing about it is that we did have an aim, we had a goal, and we were trying to go somewhere for a good purpose. But I mean, the biggest thing that annoys me with all the press that's happened off the back of it is that people do look at it and go, you know, it's great that they were both crazy, but this guy found a family, and that's the happy ending, and this guy's just crazy. He's still doing it for the love of music. He's still trying to make it. And it's like, for me, all I ever wanted to do and achieve in music was be able to wake up every day. Oh, my virus software telling me it's updated. So all I ever wanted to do in music was wake up every day, make songs, be creative, and live a completely creative life. If I could get my music out there, great. Like, if I could change people's lives by talking about some things and helping them, great. So, you know, now all I do every morning is I wake up, I hit the studio, I make beats. I spend 2 hours of my life talking to musicians and fans and trying to help them out. You know, and it's just, and I make money from that. For me, that's the absolute meaning of success, to do what you always wanted to do. You know, everything else, like fame and all that stuff, that doesn't really, I've always said it. And before we even did this, I always had this kind of annoyance with fame. And the kind of misinterpretation from success that people really should be aiming for, you know. So I just kind of get annoyed that isn't looked upon, you know. Like, damn right, I'm with my band and we're touring and we're making real music, and yeah, we'll make more records, and I'll make music forever. I don't need to get married. I've decided, like, that's my decision. I don't need to follow the same rules everyone else did: get married, have kids, settle down, be old. I don't want to do that. You know, I want to make music until I die, and I want to influence the world with my music. You know, and I think that's phenomenal.
And you know what, though, it does take, like, sadly, in this world, it does take balls to admit, you know, that tradition is not the road you're going to go down. I've had this conversation with a lot of people, like, especially right now, like, I don't really know how I feel. I've been listening to a lot of fucking Nick Cave in the last week. And now I'm starting to be like, eh, maybe I do want a girlfriend again. I don't really think so, but
yeah, man. For me, like, my biggest problem with that side of things is from the point where I decided, man, this is a path for me, I have been so heavily and deep into music that, and I was engaged through writing the book, and I've had so much love and then thrown it away because I just can't give myself fully to a person, because I can't be there for what they need from me, because music and the life of music and being, I'm so addicted to being creative, and I'd rather just be in a studio 24/7 or be on the road touring, having a great time, rocking shows, than be be with one person.
So you're you're a selfish cunt is what you're saying.
And I absolutely and I absolutely believe that in this world you should be incredibly selfish. Yeah. Because how can you make anyone else happy if you aren't making yourself happy? Do you know what I mean? That's one of my biggest beliefs. What normally happens is, you know, and this fits the whole program of what you need to do to make everyone else money, is that you get married, you settle down, and you just have kids, and you just get stuck in that kind of monotonous reproductive system. And it's then people end up being unhappy, fighting all the time, hating each other. The kids grow up with loads of issues looking at that, and then they do the same thing in their parents' image. And for me, I never want to do that. I want to be completely original. I want to go on my own path. If I find someone that, you know, that I feel like, man, I'm going to give up everything for it, then I'll do it. But, you know, music is number one, and the ability to help change and influence the world by doing music for me is way more of an incentive than any kind of money, you know?
Sure. Well, like I said, there's different people in the world. There's people that think that what you're doing is fucked up. There's other people that think that it takes balls to say that, you know, that's not what I want. So I'm one of those people. So good for you, man.
Yeah.
I have two last things, and I'll let you go. We got hooked up by my man, and I think you know him, Jamie Wilson. Okay, yeah.
Jamie's great.
Man, he's my probably biggest supporter on my podcast. Like, he's the shit.
Jamie, like, honestly, I would like to say words on Jamie, because since he got my book, he started hooking up things for me when I was on tour. He would hook up like radio interviews with people who hadn't heard or read my book or heard my music. He hooked me up with some really fucking cool people, and he didn't need to do that. That's a great thing about him, is he didn't need to do that.
Yeah, no,
but he does.
The thing about him, like, we found each other, or he found my thing on Twitter, and like right away he goes, I really like your show, and then he referenced something, and I'm like, oh, he's not full of shit, like, he is actually into it.
Yeah.
And then, like, literally everything I put out, he's on top of it. He sent me like a couple of fan art pieces. He's hooked me up with you. He's hooked me up with a couple other people that I haven't gotten together with yet, because the overseas thing is hard. But Jamie, man, I just want to tell you, like, I've said this on other podcasts, but you're the shit. So I want to thank you. And these last couple things come from him.
I second that.
Well, actually, one of them comes halfway from me, but he was asking about. Hang on, let me see if I can find this thing. Shit. Leave this page. Sorry. Let's see. Where the hell is it? Oh, hey, okay. He wanted to hear about your first trip to America, which apparently was South by Southwest. Is that right?
Yeah, this year. Yeah.
Now, what I told him I was going to do is I was going to make you tell the story freestyling. You're like, nah, fuck you.
I kind of already did that. I did that on a show where I told the story of the year in freestyle. So that's on YouTube. You can just find that on YouTube. I mean, it was a pretty crazy little adventure, you know. I mean, we went over there obviously to promote the film, but what we wanted to do was to go up to MCs in the street or any MCs and just start spitting to them and see what they thought. See if they thought we weren't skilled, or see if they thought our accent mattered. And the thing is, it didn't. Most people that we spat to, they didn't even think that we were from Scotland. They thought that we just weren't from Texas. So in this video...
That's funny.
If you go on our website, syllableandbrains.com, you can see all our diaries from that. We were in loads of ciphers with some really cool guys from the Austin Mic Exchange. And an incredible young MC called Kenny Richardson. He really took us in and introduced us to a lot of MCs in Texas. And we got to hang out with a whole bunch of cool guys. I actually loved the scene there. Everyone was kind of together. It was quite united. There was a lot of dudes, man, that were just so cool. But what we really did understand and know was, it wasn't like we were still as good as we are compared to a lot of the scene here. As we were there, it wasn't any different, you know, and why should it be different, you know, just because accents are different? It was like, no, you know, like, people were just impressed with us there as they were with us here. We even did some battle stuff, and we tore it down, and it was amazing for us to go to the States, tear it down in the fashion we did, and then walk away feeling like, yeah, you know, like, that was no biggie, you know, we got the same respect there as we do here. So I loved that trip. I got to meet so many cool people. It's very different when Americans come to London. London is very, people are very standoffish. If you go on the metro or the tubes over here, like, you know, you can't speak to people. People are just like, you know, had a hard day, don't speak to me, you know. Whereas in, I mean, maybe because it was just South by Southwest, but in Texas, man, everyone was super, super cool with us.
And they Texas were so, is a little so different cool. than anywhere else, because you go to like New York especially, but anything subway related, there's no, there, yeah, you look at your feet and that's it, you know, like.
maybe that's a worldwide thing.
I think it is. It's because, like, you know, well, maybe it's like the terrorist attack thing where now we're all looking at each other maybe, like, yeah. Does that guy have a bomb in his fucking trench coat? We don't have time for bombs in Texas. There's beer to be drank, so.
Yeah, exactly.
Well
yeah, I would recommend anyone from Texas who's listening in, if you want to experience a really good scene, music-wise, all forms of genre, like Scotland is such a thriving place. It's such a misconception that Scottish music is just all folk music and the stuff that you hear getting synchronized into American movies. It's not that, you know. Biffy Clyro isn't the only big Scottish act, and The View, they aren't the only ones that sell records. There's so many incredible rappers. There's such a good metal scene. It's such a good metal scene. I don't know if you've ever heard this band, Made in Scotland. They're an Iron Maiden cover band, but man, when you see them live, you cannot tell the difference from Iron Maiden.
Sure.
It's crazy, you know. There's so much talent over here. So if you guys are ever over, I definitely recommend, you know, Scotland for sure.
Did you guys screen the movie there?
So, oh, yeah, we did. We had a crazy time screening there. Like, I think we sold out, like, all of the premieres we were sold out. We went to the Edinburgh Festival and launched it, and that was in big cinemas, you know. That it was, it had its official premiere in Texas, but it was mostly press, you know. So the questions afterwards were very, very, you know, very press-related. But in Edinburgh, it was, like, it was cool to go to, you know, Edinburgh and be in a cinema with, like, 500 people. And just people were going crazy. People were clapping. People were, like, you know, laughing their ass off. And we had some really cool people. Like, people like, I don't know if you guys know him, but Frankie Boyle. He's a massive comedian over here.
Yeah, yeah.
Very controversial comedian. But, you know, he tweeted from the actual cinema just saying, you know, talking about the film. And there's a lot of really cool people that's tweeted about it so far, you know. So it's really cool, man. It's good that a lot of people, I would say the scene, music scene-wise, I would say 80% of the scene has understood why we did what we did and is kind of supportive of us. You get your haters, but you're always going to get your haters. You know, yeah. Haters hate us. It's what they do. And there's a lot of, like, there's a lot of crazy things happening. Like, I've had I've had people contacting me saying their family their you know, long lost family members, but their surnames are like Baine and crazy shit.
That's funny.
Yeah, but there's a lot of crazy.
Sincerely, like, Tom Brains. No, stupid. That's not how it works.
We've got these stalkers that go and people that just have problems with us that are going online and putting loads of negative things about us. It's funny, man. That's kind of what happens when you start to get, you know, your story gets heard over a certain level. People just, you know, essentially, someone said this once to me. It was like, you know, you made it when 50% of the country likes you and the other 50 wants you fucking dead. Like, that's when you made it. And
sure.
We still got a long way to go, but.
I think you're still working on the like you section of that thing.
Still working on that. I'm one of those people that like, I mean, I'm very out there with my opinions. I'm a spiritualist. I believe in, like, some really fucking fucked up things. I don't believe in telling people what your religious beliefs are, getting in people's faces, but I have very strong opinions about the music industry, and I try to help as many young artists avoid the potholes, you know, that we encountered. So I'm very in people's faces, and the thing is, I really don't care if people don't like that. You know, I have all the friends I need. You know, I don't need any more friends. I've got 4 or 5 best friends of my life and a really great family. I don't need anyone else's, love or attention. Sure. So, you know, but people always feel it necessary to either message me and say, hey, man, I fucking love your shit, or, hey, man, you're a fucking cock. You know, it's like, you know. Thanks for both, you know.
right. One last thing, and I guess what I was going to ask you, which I guess you answered and I don't need to ask it, but the one thing it was a throwaway, would have been, like, you know, that your career going forward from now, I was going to ask you if it was going to be a real bitch to get people to take you seriously, but it already doesn't matter, right?
Yeah, I think that comes down to like the quality of what you're doing. You know, like, I mean, I'm working on some solo stuff right now, but the new syllable and brain stuff, I just think when you put something out that sounds like it came from the heart, and it has some meaning, and you can clearly show skill in what you're doing, anyone with a brain who you really want to like your music, if you're you know, cognitive,
right?
You want people like your stuff who are intelligent, you know. So anyone with a brain will hear that it is good, you know, and the other people, you know, you can't really worry about them. So, and at this point, you know, yeah, like people are buying our records, but people are messaging us. Once they've bought the record, they'll message us and tell us everything they thought about that record. And for me, I sit and read that, you know, because I really want to know, you know, I want to know how it's affecting people. I want to know what people thought of the certain elements of it. And my band, Hopeless Heroic, Hopeless Heroic really saved my life music in terms of music. I fell out of love with music, and I only got back into music because I promised a friend who had just died that I would continue doing it. So music for me now is very personal. It's very like, I can't write something if I'm not doing punchlines in hip hop and doing something really technical and clever with the wordage, then I need to be writing something that I absolutely believe in, or else I'll be completely mind blocks, you know. So,
right.
So it comes from the heart. Either people can hear it and identify with it, or they don't, you know. But the people that do seem to, you know, contact us and be very vocal about what they feel about it. And those are the people I really do shit for, you know. So
sure.
For me, it's always been a case of if you can do that and get like 200 people. I've always had this idea for artists that if you can talk to 200 people and get them. And speak to them and be friends and know them, then that's all you really need, you know? Because, like, when you get to a certain level, it's in the hands of whatever, you know? When you
sign to major league, it's not your thing anymore, so.
Yeah, it's not. But you can have a close. I've done this with Hopeless Heroic. We've always had a top 200 that we've been so close with. And Jamie, he's one of them that when we hook up, we'll talk like some about serious issues and we'll get really into it. And then I'll write songs about what they were talking about. I've based a lot of my songs on fans' lives, and I have a really close relationship with people that have gotten into my music, like a guy, Mark Wilson. He's a teacher. He's a super awesome dude in Scotland. He's hooked me up with talking at his school and stuff. And I feel like me and him have a really great relationship. But this guy is just a fan. I could have just been like, ah, you're just a fan.
Right.
But that's not what I'm in it for. I'm in it to make personal relationships. And at the end of the day, if you could say to me, like, if you could go back in 10 years ago and say to me, hey, dude, in 10 years' time, you're going to be making music every day of your life. You're going to have some real fucking hardcore fans and people that are awesome around you. And people are going to listen to your music. And you're going to get to do it all the time. I would be like, you're fucking crazy. I'm from Scotland. I was born in South Africa and I was raised in Scotland from the age of 14. No one's going to give me fucking any time of day. So that's what I would have said to you 10 years ago. We went on a crazy journey. We've made our own path and we have an audience. Whatever way it takes for you to get your songs, which are your babies, to their audience, do it. Whatever way.
There you
Take
go.
It, make it, whatever. Lie, fucking rob someone. I don't give a fuck. Just make it.
One last thing. Are you guys back together now?
Yeah, Syllable and Brains. Yeah, we did it. We got back together before the film kind of came out, and we've got a really good relationship. You know, like Bill we got the new record. We made a new record at the start of the year, and now we're working on something. That was just for us to release and just get stuff out there. And we did it in an American accent and in a Scottish accent to show people the difference between the voices.
Oh, that's cool.
So that's what's out there right now. But we have a big back catalogue. We're going to be releasing that. Obviously, we've got films, the film, the motion picture coming up. So there's going to be a lot of our music coming out there. And there's obviously people that want to put it out on a major and stuff. So there's a lot going on. But it's good that the main thing is that Bill and I are friends. We hang, and when we hang, it's always a great time. It's fun again. You know, that's the thing. It wasn't fun to be around each other for a while there. So now it's fun. We both respect it. You know, he's got a family. and he needs that time with his family. It's a beautiful thing, and he respects that, you know, I produce 24/7, so this is my family.
Right.
You know, so we have this understanding between us, and we allow each other our space to be completely creative. At the end of the day, when we get in the studio, like we did at the start of the year, we're very competitive, and we just like, man, I've got to have better lyrics than this guy. He's the same way. So we push each other, you know, and I'm not sure how many people out there have that, but it's, if you do have that, that's a beautiful thing, you know. Our kind of competitiveness against each other and the way we treat each other and feel towards each other really is the thing that fuels us. So that's why Syllable and Brains is actually quite a magical little project. I don't think I'll ever probably give up or walk away from, you know.
Awesome. Well, I think we did it, dude. Anything you want to – I have a bunch of links. Like, I got the iTunes link for us over here. As far as I know, that's – is there any other places that they can see it besides iTunes?
Warner Digital are distributing over there. I'm not sure, but I think at the moment it's iTunes, but it might be making its way to certain TV channels pretty soon.
Yeah, I'll have all the links up for that, but what websites would you like people to go check out?
Well, if you want to check out stuff on Syllable and Brains, there's syllableandbrains.com. You can watch our video diaries the whole year. You know, we battled each other. That's a pretty funny video. That's on there. And then there's I do a lot of my own. I basically rhyme every single day of my life. And you know, I've got my punk rock band. You can go on Spotify and check out Hopeless Heroic or hopelessheroic.com. Pick up some of the records there, or you can just go to brainsmcleod.com and check out my solo stuff. I do a lot of video diaries and stuff. YouTube Syllable and Brains and YouTube Brains McLeod, and you'll just check out some of the stuff. Yeah, and then just hit us up on Facebook or Twitter. Anyone that wants to get in touch and ask a direct question, you know, I allocate 2 hours of every single day of my life to helping and giving as much of myself as I can. So if you want to get in contact with me, feel free. Don't feel awkward or anything. Just contact straight ahead.
Right on, man. Well, I appreciate you giving me the hour. I had a great time with you. Great. Very honest, I feel. Kind of a dick, but that's all good.
That means a lot.
I will be, just so you know, I won't send this to anywhere except for the direct message, so maybe you can help me get this podcast out when it's ready to go.
Yeah, for sure. I'll punch it around places. Yeah, for sure.
Great. I appreciate it. I'm glad you guys are back. I enjoy your stuff. What was the last thing real quick? What was that last video you guys just put out? It was like a horror video kind of.
Yeah, that was Eat Your Brains.
Oh, okay.
Eat
Your Brains video. I'm going to go find that because it's fucking great.
Yeah, Syllable and Brains Eat Your Brains video. That was real fun. Like, we just wanted to do something really like
who's
messed
the blonde?
Up. So we basically figured that let's try kill women in like three or four different ways. Let's try kill beautiful girls.
The blonde that you have in that one is lovely. So just wanted to say that.
Oh, the girls in it were so cool. There was a company that made the video with us. Were awesome. All geeks, all total geeks. You know, we wanted to make a film paying homage to like Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the whole style of the video is made like that. The company that made it was Flyboy Creative. Fantastic company. So
right,
check out their videos. They're winning awards everywhere. They're great guys. So
good deal, man.
Yeah, check it.
I'm gonna cut this. Hang on for me a second, okay?
All right, thanks, man.
Thank you, man.
Open doors, so I walk inside. Close my eyes, find my face to hide. And the shake as I take it.